I think we're going to go ahead and get started before we run out of time. I don't know if you started this recorder. Yeah, looks like it's recording. Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. I don't know if there's anything important on here except this is, I counted, the 44th presentation of this series. And it kind of amazed me that there have been that many because it seems like we just started this. But actually, the first presentation in the Seymour series was by Bob Kaplan, so it's been over 4 years ago. So we've had 43 presentations, and it's not funded at all. We call this the center. It's actually more of a joke than anything, but when PCORI was becoming popular, we thought, well, maybe we could do something that would at least have documentation of activity in the area. So we actually have zero funding. We haven't tried for funding, but we may develop this a little more in the future as opportunities come about. But we do get the food paid for every month, so that's our funding from Martin. And at the end of this set of slides, all the slides are always on Seymour site that's there. They'll also be on my, these will be on my site. And I have a list at the end of every one of the presentations that have been done. So it's sort of after the set, you can see there every single one that's actually occurred before. Okay, so today's talk is on patient safety measures. And I've done no research myself in the area yet. I haven't got any funding. I haven't done any work. But the reason I was interested in it at all is because this Jason at Chigari got funding, an R13 grant from ARC, to actually see what the state of the science was in the area. And so just almost 3 weeks ago, not quite 3 weeks ago, he actually had a group get together at ARC to talk about this, and he asked me to do a little bit of an outsider's review of the most commonly used measures. So I already had spent some time for that, and I actually called into the meeting. I wasn't there in person, and did a presentation, and then they had a Q&A about it. So this is based on that, although I've updated slides a bit. And so what I'm doing is looking at what the surveys that are being used and just providing a little bit of information about it from what I could read in the articles that were supplied to me and that I found myself, and just some observations. And anyone who has experience with these measures and wants to contribute their thoughts about them, I welcome that. As a start, though, I took this slide from CUSP, an ARC on the ARC site. It's a comprehensive unit-based safety program where they try to motivate why are we interested in patient safety. I think it's pretty obvious to everybody, but it's at least worth starting. Sometimes when I assume everybody has this as a background, then you come later and someone said, well, why didn't you sort of motivate what you're talking about? So I wanted to start with a couple slides. And we know there's been all kinds of advances in medicine and that have improved people's lives, extended the life expectancy, and so on, but there's still some errors that occur on a daily basis that shouldn't occur. It's sort of like due to a lot of factors, but we would like to be able to minimize some of the things like finding sponges inside people's bodies after they have an operation. That's the kind of thing we'd like to avoid, obviously. So that still happens. There's a lot of estimates about how often we have these problems in healthcare. And this is another slide I adapted from CUSP. So it's not that I really care about all the detail, but if you look at enough of this, you see that, you know, there's a lot of potential problems, medication errors. It doesn't have to be that frequent for it to be a problem, but the estimate is about 7% of patients suffer a medication error. And you can see there are all kinds of statistics here about, you know, numbers of people with different sorts of problems and how much it costs. And it's obviously not a trivial problem. So this is just for later if you want to go back. But I think a lot of people have heard this before. And you can find the sources if you go to the source document that is the basis for the estimates. What I want to focus on today, though, is the leading measures that are used in a self-report sense to assess a patient safety culture. And probably the most widely used and probably the best measure is the first one, so I'll spend more time on that. It's the ARC Hospital Survey on Patient Safety Culture, and I have the URLs here for you to go there if you want to. And Karen, can you pass out? I actually have each of these three surveys that are being handed out to you, because I'll be referring to them, so you might want to look at them later. So the ARC survey actually is done by Westat primarily, and Westat's involved in the CAPS project. And a lot of the things they do here, I think they parallel what happened in the CAPS survey. So not everyone knows about the CAPS survey, but that's actually not one survey, but a series of surveys that are used to assess patients' perceptions of care in all kinds of different settings. And it's the only survey, essentially, that's used on a wide-scale basis now. In this case, this is the most widely used measure, and it's got the best documentation and the best information. But you do have some other competitors, in a sense, that are similar but not identical to it. So there's a safety attitudes questionnaire, and there's this thing that sort of sounds like Psycho.
Yeah.
Great name to use, Psycho Survey, that Sarah Singer is involved with. So you do have some other ones that you probably need to look at if you're looking at the literature. The ARC survey has 42 questions that assess 12 different domains. These are reports that staff in the hospital setting are completing to tell you about each of these things, from what supervisors' expectations are to whether there's organizational learning and continuous quality improvement, what happens in terms of response to errors, is there management support for safety, and so on. So there's a lot of different things, and actually half of the 12 domains have three questions, and the other half have four questions. So on average, there's only three and a half questions that are used to assess each of these domains. So they're trying to cover a lot of different things with a few items. They don't want to overburden respondents, but they want to get a lot of information. And I've just put down here information about the 2012 comparative database. So one of the things about this particular measure is that they have hospitals that voluntarily contribute their data that they've collected on this survey so that they can have a large pool of hospitals for comparative purposes. And they do this every couple years. They actually have a 2014 version online now, too. I just used 2012 here. A lot of what you see is going to be pretty similar because it hasn't changed that much over time, but you can get a more updated set of statistics if you go to the site and look at it. But the 2012 database had over 1,000 hospitals in it. You can see the characteristics, 66% non-teaching and so on. They had 567,000 responses that are included within those hospitals, an average of 503 per hospital and a 53% response rate. Now, the response rate depends on the type of staff that you're looking at or the type of respondent. Physicians, it tends to be lower than any other group. And here's just some of the respondents, the main ones. The majority are nurses, 11% technicians, and you have about 6% that are physicians. And then if it's not here in this percentage, then it's some other category of respondent. So, depending on the hospital, they may stratify on the type of respondent, but generally they're going to try to cover people that have, 75% of the respondents have some direct patient care experience, but they also have managers and so forth that don't necessarily have direct patient care experience. They're trying to get a broad spectrum of the hospital experience. And in this 2012 result from the database, they sort of identify where it looks like hospitals overall are doing better in terms of a simple way of looking at the data. So they have multiple items that are assessing these 12 domains, and then they say, okay, we're going to say how positive is the response by basically considering the top two response categories in each item to be a positive response. So if they're asking about, for example, people support one another in this unit, then they're going to pool together, agree and strongly agree, the two most positive responses. If it's a negative statement, they're going to pool the disagree and strongly disagree responses to that. So we have safety problems in this unit, then the positive response would be if they gave disagree or strongly disagree. So teamwork within units, and again, if you look at 2014, it's going to be similar to this. Teamwork within units has the most positive response overall And Teamwork, you probably all know, but it does have a little explanation here. This is actually, I've just cut and pasted from the database report that WestStaff compared on this particular slide. So they tell you, you know, staff support each other, treat each other with respect, and work together as a team. Then the next category that has got positive responses is, it's a kind of a weird label, but it's basically that the managers and supervisors promote patient safety. So it's 75% positive. And then continuous improvement, 72%. And then management support for patient safety, it's about 72% positive. So that's the best results they get in a simple sense. And then the most negative results are for whether they're non-punitive response to error. So 44% positive. So that means that staff feel like if they make a mistake and report it, that it could be held against them. You know, and they may be kept in their personal file. And then there's a care coordination domain, handoffs and trade-offs, 45% positive. And then staffing, 56% positive, where there's a fair number of people who feel like there's not enough staff to handle the workload. So that's descriptive information that they provide on that survey. And it's kind of a nice database, a lot of cases and so forth. I'm going to go back to each survey and just sort of make some comments in a minute, but I just want to introduce them first. The Safety Attitudes Questionnaire doesn't have as many items. It covers fewer domains, but the domains are a subset pretty much of what you have in the ARC metric. There's a lot of overlap. There's some similarity, but you know, it's pretty much overall similar, more so than different. And then the PSYCHO survey, again, it's got fewer items than the ARC measure, has fewer domains represented, and they have different number of items that are tapping into these different domains. So it's different groups of people who are looking at the same thing in slightly different ways. And you've got the questionnaires in front of you. So when I started looking at these things, the first thing I did was just sort of look, and I wish Jose Calderon was going to be here, right? And I was hoping he would be here because he would have comments about this, but I just sort of looked at it qualitatively and said, okay, let's start with the ARC measure, which is sometimes just referred to as SOPS, and can I find any problems just in looking at it? So if you're looking at it there, you can see the full set of items. I've just abbreviated here with, you know, one screenshot. But what I focused on is, without even paying that much attention to the wording of the items, it's a strongly disagree to strongly agree scale. And if you looked at this and said, well, could they have done better or done something different? The one thing I looked at that I thought, well, probably doesn't matter anyway, but look at this response scale. I mean, it may jump out at you, but you see it says strongly agree, strongly disagree. Then it has disagree, agree, and it has neither. So I thought, first of all, neither, I'm not sure what that means. Neither what? I mean, you can imply that that means neither agree or disagree, but it would probably have been better if they were explicit, because generally that's what you would do. So neither is probably not a great shorthand to use. I don't know that it confuses anybody, because most respondents are kind of getting the idea that you've got some rank order in terms of what you're trying to represent. But still, that's probably not optimal, and that's the way they laid out the questionnaire. And agree, you know, it might be somewhat agree or somewhat disagree might have been better. So it's a relatively minor issue, but it's still like you kind of wonder, why did they do that? And it's probably not optimal. So just that's one thing in that survey. So if you look at the other ones, I think there are more problems in the other surveys. So if you look at this one, the SAC, and it's actually similar. I think the SAC and the other survey we look at are maybe they sort of talk to one another because they have a very similar layout. So their idea was, and this is what you can see better if you look at the survey itself, is let's cram everything on two pages. We've got a lot of questions, and let's just cram it all together on two pages, and that way it'll save money, I guess, or it'll make people think that there's less burden.
Right.
But look at the way it's laid out in terms of you're trying to respond to this. So on one of these surveys, I guess on the SAC that I turned around and actually indicated which items are representing each of the domains, and I sort of responded in the most positive response. It's like when you're in school and you have to fill in the Scantron seat. If you're not really careful, you may not pick the right response choice. So everything's so crammed together, it's very hard to complete. And, you know, agree strongly is often what you'd like to pick as the most positive response. Well, that's right here, so you have to be very careful that you're in the second column away from the right side. If you go too far over, which you might naturally do, you're going to pick a not applicable response, which is missing data. So I think the layout of these are not optimal. And the other thing is this not applicable response charts. It's never a good idea in surveys to just say not applicable, because you don't know how respondents are going to interpret it. And not applicable will lead to more missing data, and it will lead to confusion in terms of what it means when people give that response. So you probably throw away a lot of data you wouldn't like to have. It would be a lot better if you think it's necessary to actually have a tailored not applicable response, which is the not applicable has wording that refers to the item itself, so that you really make clear what you mean by not applicable. You don't just leave it up to the respondent. So those are just qualitative observations. And again, the same thing is on this. It's basically the same kind of layout, crammed together, and they have a not applicable response. So someone was really mimicking the other in both of these surveys, in the PSYCHO and the SAC. And they're probably not the best surveys. Now, of course, these are staff, so they're probably better at filling these out than patients are. But still, even as a staff, you're burdened by this. And if you're, you know, having to deal with this formatting problem, you would be more likely not to respond or more likely to make errors. So these are just sort of observations I was making just to say, okay, well, you probably could lay these things out better and improve the quality of the data you collect just that way. In terms of the analysis they've done, they've actually, if you look at the literature, you know, there are some deficiencies in terms of what people have done, but sort of the overall pool of what's been done is actually pretty state-of-the-art or state-of-the-science. So just the kind of things that they do typically, that as you always want to do in a survey, is assess reliability. Well, what do they do most commonly? And again, these surveys are at the hospital level primarily. They also have some versions in some cases that I'll get at other settings, but hospital is the most common setting. And so what you're trying to do is get different respondents to tell you about the same hospital, and you would like those responses to be pretty much in line with one another. They don't have to be identical, but you have to have some common variance. So if there's really something true about the hospital, then you should not get completely different responses from different people that are telling you about the same hospital. You should get some agreement at the hospital level, and then you want to have variation between hospitals. So when you're estimating reliability for this situation, you're really interested in hospital-level reliability. But what they have primarily done, though, is what we always do. This is not working at all. Okay, it's actually interesting. This doesn't work in this situation. But what they do is this formula here, the two-way mixed effects, which is Cronbach's alpha, coefficient alpha, internal consistency reliability. So what should show up is a circle here to that and say, okay, most commonly people are using that, which is a mean squared between minus the mean squared EMS, which is the interaction between item and response and respondents. So they're saying, for example, if you have four items measuring one domain, what they're going to do is look at the mean squared between respondents and then compare that to the mean square that's an error estimate in terms of answering items in different ways. So if we've got four items measuring the same thing, what this is going to tap into is, are they saying different things when they're answering different items that are supposedly measuring the same thing? And so that estimate is okay if you're interested in the individual and how they're responding as a person. But in this case, we're really not so interested in individuals and trying to give them a score on safety. We're trying to get a safety score for the hospital. So that's fine to look at that, but what you really want to focus on is the one-way formulas here, and primarily this one, which is a reliability formula, bottom left corner. That is going to give you an estimate of between hospital variation in responses versus within hospital variation. So you'd like to have large between hospital variation because they should vary in their level of safety, and you'd like to have less within hospital variation because you hope you're getting agreement between people who are telling you about the same hospital. So there's been less attention to that, but there has been some attention. Some of the articles will look at that, but that's really what should be the primary reliability estimate that they're reporting, because that tells you how many people you need at each hospital of responses in order to get reliable data. So you'd like to have reliability, for example, 0.70 or higher. Well, that's going to take a certain number of people at each hospital, and that's the only way you're going to figure it out. You can use either of these formulas. This is going to tell you what the reliability is that you have based on whatever number of responses you have. This will tell you the estimated reliability if you only had one respondent, the interclass correlation, but then you can figure out how many respondents you need to get whatever level of reliability you'd like. And so there needs to be more of those estimates, because that's the primary way that these are getting used. They're at the hospital. These are hospital-level attributes, and so they need to know what sample size is needed to get adequate reliability. So that's been done in some articles, but not as much as it could. They also report this statistic, which is kind of interesting. It's the only place I've seen it, another, quote, reliability estimate. And I actually don't think it's all that valuable. It's somewhat useful, but it doesn't really give you as much information as that last thing I was talking about, the one-way analysis of variance estimate that separates between hospital versus within hospital variance. This one doesn't look at between hospitals at all. It's just a within estimate, and all it does is look at the variance on the measure, like the scales that they create for multiple items, the observed variance for a hospital, and then it compares that to this estimate here of what you'd expect randomly. So if you had random measurement error, you're going to have a lot of variance. So it's looking to see if this estimate of actual variance is low relative to the variance you'd have if it was just random error in terms of responses. And if that's the case, if this is small relative to that, this ratio will be small, and then 1 minus that ratio will be large. So this is some number that people report. And the way they estimate the error variance is using the number of categories in the items that you've administered, squaring that, subtracting 1, and then dividing by 12. And this is all explained in a Journal of Applied Psych article. So it tells you something about responses and variance relative to a complete noise, but it doesn't really tell you about anything relative to between hospital variance. So it may be somewhat useful, but it's definitely not as useful as the other statistics. And in fact, if you look at what's been reported, a lot of times this looks high and the hospital level reliability is zero or not very good. So if you looked at this by itself, you'd be very misled. It might be supplementary information, but it's, you know, probably not nearly as useful in general. Okay, so another thing they do, so they do reliability to some extent, not perfectly all the time, but if you look at enough articles, you do see people doing all of these sort of estimates. And they've also done pretty well at looking to make sure that when they have multiple domains, that they're really measuring multiple things. So you can look at reliability, that's going to tell you within a domain whether you're getting reliable or consistent results. But they also look to say, well, we said we have 12 domains, are we really getting 12 distinct pieces of information? So they do either an item scale correlation matrix like this. So these might be three items measuring, you know, teamwork, although I say depression here. These three items could be, management support, and these three items could be, you know, enough resources to have safe patient care. And they look to see what are the correlations of those items with the scale that they are supposedly part of or representing, corrected for overlap of the item with that scale total, versus the correlation of the item with scores on other scales that are supposedly measuring other things. And you don't want this kind of result. If you got this kind of result, then you'd have a look like this guy right here. Because this would tell you, you think you're measuring three things, but you're really measuring one thing, because every item is correlated equally with all scales. So you can't say that item one in this case is measuring depression, because it's also representing anxiety and anger. So if they had something like this, then they'd say, well, we thought we had three things, but we're really only measuring one. What they really want to see is the next thing, something like this, where you get the items measuring depression and it correlates more highly with the other items in depression than it does with anxiety and anger. And there's been a lot of that reported. In some cases, they've actually done this method exactly, item scale correlations. Singer did that with the psycho measure. So you'll see articles, I think, in Health Services Research that reports that. The same idea would be if they do factor analysis. So the ARC measure, they've actually done very sophisticated factor analysis And it's the same idea in terms of interpretation. You're not just using correlations, you're essentially using regression coefficients where there's a hypothetical factor that's regressed on the items. But the way you interpret it is the same thing. You'd like to have a pattern like this. You don't have to have zeros, but you don't want to have big factor loadings for items on things they don't measure. You want the factor loadings to be big on the things that they do measure. In the ARC, in their publications, they actually do multi-level factor analysis, which is the best thing you can do. So it's taking into account individual responses and then also at the higher level of the hospital. So they've actually done really good work in that regard overall. In terms of validity, that's an important next step. So they show it's reliable and it's measuring distinct domains. Then they want to say, well, is it really measuring what we want it to measure? So we're talking about self-reports, and of course it's self-report about safety at the staff level. Well, does that really mean anything? Does that really mean that it's a safe hospital or not? We have other indicators of safety. So there hasn't really been as much in this area published yet, but I know they're aware of it. And a few examples where it's been done, primarily, this is probably the best example, Sarah Singer in 2009, where she looked at 91 hospitals with 18,000 responses and found that better safety climate overall. So she summed up the psycho items together and got one overall score. What was reported by people, that was related to lower relative incident of patient safety indicators as defined by our quality indicator support team. So this hospital survey data was collected 2004, and she got 2004 MedPAR data. And I have a list of the indicators at the end here that you can look at. But basically, it was a sum of those 12 of those indicators. And so it was more not self-report data that's telling you about the hospital, more record data about what happened in terms of things that would clearly be determined to be bad outcomes for patients. And you did see a correspondence, a significant correspondence. So that was nice. More importantly, she found that it was really the frontline personnel, not the managers, who really seemed to know what was going on in their report. So you'd probably want to have more stock in the frontline personnel rather than the managers, because it was only their perceptions of quality that were related to these more objective indicators of patient safety. Let's see. Okay, so I came to that point and said, okay, they've done pretty well with all this stuff. And then what I wanted to say is, well, what might they do in the future beyond what I said qualitatively? You know, the surveys may not be perfectly laid out, although the ARC one is a lot better. I mean, there's sort of minor little thing I said about the ARC thing, but in terms of the layout and everything, it's a much better design survey. But I didn't see anything in this regard being done. So most of it relates to item response theory and what's gone on in the PROMISE project. But there are like these five things that I think that they could do, and this is what I was actually recommending to them. First is a very basic thing is, you know, a lot of times they're scoring these things on a 0 to 100 possible range or something like that, where the metric means nothing except what's the top score, what's the bottom score. And if you have the mean and standard deviation, you can kind of get some idea about it. But a really easy thing they could do, especially the ARC indicator, is just to score things on a T-score metric. So this has been done forever with the SF-36. It's done in the PROMISE project routinely, and it was done years ago in some psychological measures like the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. But if you have enough data so that you can get a reference group, like you can have U.S. hospitals as a reference, you have this comparative database, you can just set the metric so the mean is 50 and the standard deviation is 10. Or if you want to set it to any mean and standard deviation you want, that's fine. But T-score by convention is often used. And it's very easy to do that if you create a Z-score, you know, where the mean is 0 and the standard deviation is 1. So you take all the raw scores and you transform them so they have a mean of 0 and a standard deviation 1. Well, you can then make any mean and standard deviation you want by a general formula. In this case, you put in 50, that's what you're going to add to make the mean 50, and you multiply every score by 10. So if you multiply every score by 10, that makes the standard deviation 10. If you then add 50, you're going to get a mean of 50 for the new distribution. So they could do that, like ARC could do that, and then it would be a lot easier to interpret the data. You don't need to know what the mean and standard deviation is. for different domains because it's always 50 standard deviation of 10. So that would be the simplest thing they could do. The next thing they could do is if they started to, it may be difficult in some cases because they have so few items, but even with few items, you could do something like this. They could start to look at category response curves. Now, ideally, you would do this by getting an IRT estimate, which is a more logistic estimate of the underlying score, but you could still do it the way they score it now, a simple summated scores. If you did the simple summated scores, on the x-axis, you would have a scale score on whatever domain they're measuring, like teamwork. So you get a score, and that's down here, and then what you plot up here is the probability that someone's going to pick each response choice based on their total score on whatever you're measuring. And this is a way to look at when they have the strongly agree to strongly disagree response set, for example, are those different response categories really being used the way they should be or not? And this is an example here from the CAPS dental survey. So we published this in Medical Care in 2006. And this shows a great item, an item that you'd like. It's we were measuring, in this case, communication between dentist and patients. And this is a never-to-always response scale. So there are four response options. And so you're going to get four different curves. I'm trying to remember this particular item that's so good. It's a standard CAPS item. How often, in this case, it's adapted to dental care. How often did your dentist listen carefully to you? Okay, and then we have other items that are measuring communication. Well, if you say never, that's the most negative response. If you say always, that's the most positive response, and then usually is the next one down, and then sometimes is the next one down from there. So we know going in that this is the rank order that we expect, that people who are least pleased with the care are going to say never to this item. Those who are most pleased are going to say always and in between here. And what you like to see are curves like this, where every response category at some point along the continuum of communication, which could be based on just a simple summated score. In this case, it was based on an IRT estimated score. But somewhere on that continuum, it's going to be most likely to be selected. And you want them to order in the way that you expect. If over here was sometimes and always was over there, we'd have a trouble because it wouldn't make sense. The rank order is not sensible, but in this case it is sensible. So what we're seeing is that you have, if you feel like communication is really bad overall based on the communication scale, you're very, very high probability of saying never. And that probability goes down as you get more and more along the x-axis, your total score is higher. And then at some point right here, the most probable response you're going to have is sometimes. And then when you go over here, it's then going to become usually. And then anybody from this point on, it's going to be always. So this is the shape you'd like. You might like it to be pushed to the right more, you know, because there's right. This is the mean for your sample here. So right at the mean, the average person is going to pick always. And we know that the items are skewed. CAPS items are skewed. People are generally happy with care, so that's just life as it is. But this is a good result overall in terms of the way the response categories are performing. Now, they've never reported anything about that, so we don't really know how the response scale is going. What you wouldn't want to see is this, and this is what we saw in the dental survey, the CAPS dental survey. This question was, how often did you have a hard time speaking with your dentist? And it's a disaster item. It was 72.
When your mouth was open, being
drill
going.
Right. It's too subject to all kinds of interpretation. But the idea was to take the CAPS core items and say, well, can we do anything more? What are some items that might be tried out? And this one was a bomb. Because look at the way the response curves are. You don't know anything about, this item tells you nothing about communication because you don't have what we saw before, the sensible response pattern. And you know, down here, you're just equally likely to pick, you know, or almost equally likely to pick always as you are to pick sometimes. And, you know, it's just a mess. The curves are all over the place. But, you know, this is almost everybody's picking never anyway. So if you look at that, you would learn something about the item. It probably will show up in other ways, too. It probably won't be correlated with the other items and so forth, but not always. I mean, you might find like one response category is not so good or that two of them really are not differentiating. You could just learn a lot more about your item. So they should do that. So more generally, some other things about IRT that would be useful, again, is IRT, what is it doing? Well, it's trying to array people and items together. So you have people that are more likely to score high or low on whatever it is you're measuring, and you could have hospitals maybe more likely to score high or low on whatever you're measuring if you get at that level, which is really the right level for this situation, but we'll keep it at the person level. And you have items that are more or less difficult to score high or low on. So the simplest thing to talk about, and you can look at PROMIS for more detail, would be physical functioning. So this might be, can you run a mile? And this person could be someone who's an athlete. And this is like a continuum is, you know, zero, you could think of a Z-score, zero is average, or if you wanted a T-score, it would be 50 is average. And this is a higher score, more positive, and this is more negative. So zero is the average person, and maybe person two is just above the average. Person three is quite a bit further above the average in terms of where they score on physical functioning. But you want to align the items so that the item fits the person. So can you run a mile is a good question for a person who's an athlete maybe here, but it's not a good person for person one who's scoring really low on physical function. This person may be in bed and can't get out of bed. So if I ask them, can you run a mile, I'm wasting my time. But this might be, you know, can you walk to the kitchen? And this could be, you know, can you walk two blocks? We can look on data and say, where do all the items array on this continuum from likelihood of being endorsed in a sample? And we can then put people on that same continuum. And what that allows us to do is to say, okay, we're going to pick the best items for the people and be more efficient. So standardized tests do this all the time, rather than giving everybody the same set of items. Because response burden is such a big deal. That's why two of these surveys, the SAC and PSYCHO, crammed together everything in two pages. I think somehow that's going to fool people. You still have a lot of questions. But there's a lot of examples. GRE, the Army does this. There's the security dealers, and there's the nursing boards and PROMIS for health-related quality of life now, where you can use computers now to administer the best items. So you only administer enough items until you get reliable data for any one respondent, and then you can stop. Now, it may be harder in this world to do it because they don't have that many items in each of their domains, but at least they could consider it as a possible way of being more efficient. The other thing is these surveys are often done on the web or on a computer, so it's already set up to do it. In other cases, you have to make sure computers are there, and they've come now in this age, but in the past, they weren't as widely available. But here, they're pretty widely available, so you could save time potentially for people by doing that. The other thing is, in addition to saving time, you know you're going to do better than the standard test, because at least for the same number of items, because we've got plenty of data where that's the case. So in PROMIS, there's all kinds of examples of this, but in terms of physical functioning, we compared legacy measures like the SF-36 in terms of reliability, the hack that Jim Fries developed that's used in arthritis a lot. We also did other variations. The PROMIS had a 20-item form that everybody filled out every item. And then we simulated what would happen if you did 10 items to everybody, but you picked the 10 items that fit where they are in the continuum based on their responses as they go along. And you're always going to see something like this where standard error is here. You want that to be lower. So that standard error on the left axis, and then over here, you can see what that translates in terms of reliability. So 0.90 reliability is equivalent to standard error of 3.2 when you're talking about T-scores, and 0.95 reliability is 2.2 in T-score world. And see the red dots here. It's always going to be throughout the continuum, you're going to get the best result overall if you use a CAT. And, you know, this green line here for the PROMIS hack 20-item scale, which is twice as long as the CAT, it never really does better, and it does worse at the more positive ends. So we know for sure that would lead to better reliability, and it would save time if they can get it to work. The other thing that you can do that they haven't done at all is look at, are you really getting similar responses from different people? So they've got all kinds of different staff that are completing this, and they don't really know whether the scale is working the same for the different people. Now, they know if there are mean differences. You know, you can always look at a mean difference and say, you know, one person scored this higher than another, or one type of people did different means, but you don't really know if the scale is being used the same. So one important thing, it was historically called looking at bias, like in test scores. You know, is this item equally good for Hispanics than non-Hispanics, or blacks versus whites? Well, they could be looking at that, and the underlying thing that you're looking for here is the probability of choosing every response category in an item should be the same, regardless of your characteristics, once you have an estimate of a total score. So if you're measuring teamwork and you get a score on teamwork, you control for that. Once you control for that, you should have the same probability of picking any response category if the scale is working the same. So you can do that by subgroup. So simple examples are shown here. Again, this is depressive symptoms, but let's say I cry when I'm upset. Could be one item that you think is measuring depression. If you administer that item along with other items on depression, you're going to find a difference between men and women. This isn't real data, but this is the type of thing that has been found before, where the curve should be the same. You shouldn't have a difference, a separation here. When you have a separation, this means that the probability, in this case, it's just a yes-no kind of response, so we just have a dichotomy. So the only choice is whether you got yes or no. But the probability of a yes is much higher for women than men. And that's why the curve is shifted to the left. So even at lower levels of depression, so this is a low depressive symptom score, these are high, you're going to get equal probability of responding yes for men and women when women actually have less depression than men, because the curve is shifted to the left. If it's right on top of one another, then the probability is all the same at the same level of depression. And if the curves are parallel like this, that tells you that it's location diff. It's always a consistent difference. So if you use this item to estimate depression, you're always going to say women, at least based on that item, are more depressed than men. But we know it's not just indicating depression, it's just a gender difference. So we wouldn't want that item. Or we could have an item, I get sad for no reason, and then maybe we would find a difference. This is all hypothetical between whites and African Americans. And again, they're not right on top of one another, but this is an example of slope diff, because there's an interaction. So at some point on the continuum, African Americans are more likely to have a yes at the same level of depression than whites, and it flips vice versa. So they've done none of this, and they could do it. And that would be interesting, because there's a high probability that you could get a difference in this setting and what people say about safety. I think the final thing I was going to talk about, and this is maybe even the most important thing, as long as there are multiple measures, you've got the ARC measure, the SAC, and you've got the PSYCHO, you've got data that comes in, and you want to be able to compare it. So if someone used the SAC, what does that say about the ARC measure? Can you estimate the score that you would have gotten if you administered the ARC measure? So there's linking that could be done of these different measures out there. And there's actually one example that's been done, I'll mention briefly, but there are different ways to link. But one of the ways that you try to link is, you know, if you administer the same two surveys to the same people, like you did the SAC and you did the ARC measure, you could then compare the responses, and based on the data that you get, if you get a good enough sample, you could equate the scores or link the scores. So if you have a score of 5 on the ARC measure and you have a score of 8 on the SAC measure, those might be equivalent. And the way you determine if they're equivalent is you make them match in terms of the percentages of people, the percentile score. So you don't know going in, because they're on different metrics. They're not scored the same way, but you could sort of match them on how they assign people in terms of where they stand relative to other people. Are they the 100th percentile, the 50th percentile, or whatever? And you could do that. Another way of thinking about it is you equate the scores in terms of standard deviation above or below the mean. So a 5 on one measure may be the same as 8 on another, because they both represent one standard deviation above the mean. And you can do this in a variety of ways, but the two most common ways are equal percentage linking, and then you could do IRT linking if you get into IRT, where you actually map the scores, because you calibrate all the items together and say, okay, where are these items on the same distribution? Okay. There are a lot of assumptions of linking. I'm not going to go into them in great detail, but you have to be measuring the same thing. That's what means unidimensional. If you're measuring one thing like apples and another thing like oranges and you try to link them, that doesn't work very well or at all. They have to be highly correlated, and you want to have subgroup invariance in terms of when you compare one score with another, different subgroups should have a similar difference or correspondence between those two scores. You should be looking at that. That's something that often is ignored, but you don't want to assume that what applies overall is really going to apply to every subgroup. Just quickly, the one example at all, it's really a very preliminary basic example of any attempt, was this Echegaray guy, Jason, who had this conference in 2012. He predicted the SAC teamwork domain score from the SOPS teamwork and communication scales. So he looked to see what was correlated first, and then he got a regression equation and accounted for 54% of the variance. So he's just going to have a regression model that predicts one score from another. So that's a very basic way to do this. You could do a lot more. He also did that for the SAC safety domain and predicted it from organizational learning from the SOPS. So that's the only example there's been where there's been an attempt to link two scores. One thing I should say is in his article, he has a correlation matrix that has all kinds of SOP domain scores and a subset of the SAC scores. And I actually analyzed those correlations and found that pretty interesting. There are about 16 domains there. It's essentially unidimensional across all these domains. So even though they say they're measuring different domains and they have some evidence that they have some distinction, mostly what's going on is pretty much one dimension. So like if you're familiar with principal components, the first one is 8, the next one is 1.28, and then you go down to 0.96. You can get two factors if you force it, but the second factor has some commonality among some of the SOP scales, 5 of them. But what's mostly going on is you're kind of measuring one thing repeatedly. I mean, you have a lot of common variance among these different domains. So a lot more of that could be done to really figure out, yeah, you're saying you're measuring 12 things and you've got some unique information, but primarily you're telling the same story repeatedly. Okay, so I'm going to stop there. This is just your bibliography that I used so far. There's a lot more things that could be done. And then here's a picture where I was last week. If anyone can figure out where that is, you win a prize.
Baltimore.
Well, that's a good guess. But it's not that beautiful in Baltimore. Quebec City. So there's my website. Just quickly, if anyone wants to know, those are the 12 indicators, the patient safety indicators I referred to earlier. So I'm going to stop for questions. I know you have a lot. I can see it in your eyes. Victor has a question.
Great talk, Ron. I have no questions.
Oh, very disappointed. I have a thing. Since Victor said that, he made a compliment. An example of a patient safety problem would be, I handed Victor this. You all have that. Mm-hmm. It had a staple on the left side.
Right.
Victor stapled on the right side. When I got this, I looked at it and I go, oh my God, I hate staples on the right side. I should take this back to him.
There's actually a reason for that. Our copier kept eating. I fed the pages in from the left. The pages were sticking together. So I had to flip them over to get it to eat them.
I was kidding, but you know, that's the thing is, it's like if you don't like say exactly what, things can happen. That wasn't a major.
You didn't specify, so it's really your fault.
Well, that's right. I'm not saying it's your fault. But hopefully no students were hurt by it. It was a near miss.
I can't guarantee that.
Okay. Any questions at all?
Were you working on this because of some UCLA initiative, or?
Were you here in the very beginning?
No, but
if you look at the, I haven't had it done. If you go back, basically there was this conference that ARC funded in R13. Jason Echegaray was the PI, and then he asked if I would just, as an outsider, review these.
Nice.
You can jump to slide one on the top real quick.
Yeah, I'm not really good at that. Now, how do I do it?
Just roll up.
What do you mean?
Up into the green bar. Okay. And there's a list of all your slides right there with a number.
Oh,
38.
So just click on one?
It would just go all the way to one.
You mean like, I see.
Yeah, it's just like that.
Oh, I've learned something. That's not literally it, but it's the next one. Yeah. It's the next one if it goes to it. I see. Now it's stuck on it, huh?
No, you just have to get out of there. Just click.
Oh, okay.
Now.
Ah, that's why. There we go. I learned another thing. This one.
Got it.
So it's almost 3 weeks ago.
Are these being used outside of a research setting? Like, are they being used?
Yeah, they're used. Actually, there's a lot of materials. If you look on the ARC site, they've really done a good job of, like, tools to what you can do if you find results that aren't desirable, you know, like what you can do to improve. And a lot, you know, these hospitals are submitting their data. They're supposedly working on improving patient safety. And they actually have trends over time. They report, they have a big report they do every 2 years, and the trends over time in a subset of hospitals, you know, 2 years where there seems to be small improvements, you know, like percent positive going up by 1 to 2%. So that's sort of the idea to move it all.
Is it required in some way, or
no?
It's voluntary.
It's voluntary right now. I don't know if they'll ever require it. I mean, you know, I haven't heard. I could ask, you know, because I know all the people that are working on it, but I haven't asked them. Yes.
So Ron, you had a slide on validity. Has anyone used this? I guess you just showed us what you found, but to your knowledge, were there additional studies on using this to look at HACs or the Medicare HAC program, hospital acquired?
I don't think there's any other.
This is all like organizational theory type stuff. It's conceptually, I'm not familiar with it. Is this all?
Yeah, that's.
Makes sense that it would be linked.
I think that's the best validity study I cited. Now, there's worse ones that just look at correlations among the scales and so forth, but I think there's a lot of opportunity.
There's
in fact,
a lot out there, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, the ARC, if you go to the website, the database is available.
Oh.
Yeah, just like CAPS says, they have a database. And it's interesting, I'm not sure what it means. I was actually on a call today with Joanne Sora, who works on this. I was going to ask her, but there was no chance. It says you can get de-identified hospital data, and then it says you could also request identified, and I don't know what that meant. There must be some qualification. I don't know how much they identify the hospitals, but
the full set of hospitals?
Well, that's what I'm not sure. It says identifiable. Maybe that means some subset of identification. I don't quite understand what that means, but I was kind of surprised to see it. The way it's usually reported, like in the report, it's overall. That's all you see. Or they'll break it down by bed size or some other characteristic.
No, that's fine, though, academic, you know, teaching.
Yeah.
Because they just came out with a HAC report saying that teaching hospitals were much worse than everyone else on HACs. And people were up in arms saying, well, it must be the measurement stuff. And so tying this in would be really useful to just sort of validate whether they actually are worse.
Right, absolutely.
My question was whether you could get de-identified hospital data. So
you have to follow up to know really what that means. But it is interesting that they say that on the website. So I was curious how far that goes. Now, usually each hospital, of course, that participates, they know their score, and they actually give them an Excel file to score it themselves. That's on the site too. But then they have the full set that they can pair it with. But I don't know. That'd be interesting to find. Okay. Go ahead.
So at the end, you said when you look at the 12 domains, it appears that they are
primarily
just like answering one question in a sense.
Yeah, but I don't want to be too. It's not largely, but that doesn't mean there isn't some unique information.
Right.
It's just there's a lot of cases like that. The same thing with CAPS. You know, those things are pretty highly correlated. So there's a lot of things in life we measure, really. Everything we think of, health and everything. There are correlations there, and the biggest message is probably one thing, but then how important is the unique stuff, you know, we sort of have to determine. But I don't think people have examined it here so much to know that really, if you look at it, it looks like you've got a lot of common variants, and you should recognize that.
Because it seems like that could be really important to tease out ahead of time, because people are looking at this data, and then they may make interventions. And then when we come back and say, "Oh, yeah, this did this or this did that," we're addressing this domain, and things have happened and or didn't happen, and it may be because there's so much conflation across the items.
Right. Well, yeah, that was definitely big implications for what you do, and other other times people say, "Well, the domain that's most highly related to if you had some overall score." That's the one we want to work on as long as we're not doing so well, because it'll maybe improve everything overall.
Right.
But it could be, if you work on anything, it may be likely to change everything to some extent.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.